Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
This is Too Many Minutes, a One Heat Minute Productions podcast miniseries cracking the code of Phil Alden Robinson's 1992 tech caper, Sneakers. To decode this evergreen, era-bridging, infinitely rewatchable masterpiece, we're splitting the film into its component parts, much like its multi-generational ensemble cast for the ages. Since seeing Sneakers in cinemas all the way back in 1992, I've been trying to deconstruct the alchemy. Why does every single element harmonize so perfectly? Is it the score, the compositions, the performances, the script, the setting, the subject, the actors? After 32 years, I finally cracked it. I found Janus's little black box.
Don't look, listen.
The addition of each new cast member, each new voice, each new tone, what's on the page doesn't just bring them together. Rather, it becomes the framework to support what all these actors mean then and mean now to movie lovers across the decades. Phil Adam Robinson becomes a music producer as much as a director, remixing and sampling these performances, turning up the volume on their very specific music. This is a supergroup, so let's dig in and see how each bar, each sample, makes Sneakers a best of album at the jump. In episode 6, you're going to hear from author, screenwriter, and podcaster Lee Zachariah, and for the first time this series, Javier Panza. Journalist, Bay Area born and bred, and Sneakers head from way back. So keep those ears open, because I'm going to make you an honorary blind person. Now, as this is a San Francisco and Bay Area movie, it feels kind of a perfect crossover moment to start to think about what music is this bringing. Well, the other great San Francisco movies are, of course, Vertigo, Bullet. But as the guy behind Zodiac Chronicle, I think this episode needs to kick off with a little tune from Three Dog Night, Easy to Be Hard.
How can people be so heartless? How can people be so cruel? Easy to become.
Here is Lee Zachariah.
So I recently took an extended trip around America, and of course I had to visit all like the big movie locations of my childhood, Bodega Bay from The Birds, the Bradbury Building from Blade Runner. But Sneakers was the one I went all out on. I had to find as many locations from that film as possible.
And can I just say, for folks who are listening, Lee was going on this huge trip, this amazing, you know, huge, like, victory lap of a person, like, career accomplishment levels. And he was texting me randomly at all sorts of hours of the night. So I knew that he was international. So, you know, and he was like, I'm definitely going to all these locations on sneakers. And what I want to say is, for folks who are going to hear Lee pop up in this series as we go through and we use some of these correspondence tapes, Lee was a huge reason why I finally pulled the trigger on the series. I want to thank him while he's here with me, because he just said, like, we talked about sneakers on a physical media show. We, like, a couple of the boys and I, Chris Candy and Rob Belushi, talked on a Too Much Movie episode with the great Stephen Tobolowsky. We were so excited to talk to him. And there was still sneakers itching, like, I needed to do it in the way that we have done so many of our shows, because I feel like that's how I'm able to, like, exercise the demon, so to speak. And Lee was like, just in case you'll ever do the sneaker show, I think he probably read my mind that it was just inevitable. It's like, just in case, I'm going to go to these locations. I'm going to record some stuff. And so what you're going to hear is amazing stuff. And I couldn't believe it when I listened to it. And so I'm hoping that you guys have the same experience, but I just want to thank you while we're here together recording this, because I feel like you were like one of those last bits where I was like, you know what? I do not want anyone else to do this. And not because I don't want other folk to do some of, you know, to have a reaction or a response or to resonate with what we do, but there's certain things that the only choice that I have in my heart when I'm choosing a film that I'm going to obsess over and deep dive on is that I have an unhealthy relationship with it. And I feel like I'm going to let everyone have their relationship, but this unhealthy relationship needs like a really bad breakup album. And this is my breakup album for sneakers. Not to get rid of it, but it's just like, I need to get all of my heart out. And I want to thank you, because I feel like you poured your heart into not only every bit of contribution you've done for the show so far, but particularly these correspondences, which one of them made me howl so much in my house. I think I may have woken up my wife. But thank you so much.
I spent months. Oh, I'm so glad. And I'm so honored to have been such a big part of getting you to do this. And I won't deny that me actually going to these locations was me trying to manipulate you into doing it. Dude, I drove out here. Surely you've got to do a podcast. that piece that you're talking about that made you howl, I actually waited months before sending it to you because I wasn't sure whether I should or not. And then I was just like, you know what? He has to hear this.
It's so funny. It's like Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's one of the funniest. It's so funny. I was like, I can't believe that what you said. Anyway, people are going to hear it. Yep. So
you'll hear it.
But you know, thank you for your not so subtle manipulation.
I'm currently standing outside the Bank of California in San Francisco. This is the place that they pulled the sneak on in the beginning of the film to test the bank security systems. I'm thrilled to say it's still standing and still appears to be operating as a bank. So clearly they knew what they were doing. The security upgrades work. I don't know if you can hear that well, but I'm currently driving over the Bay Bridge that connects Oakland to San Francisco. And you better believe that I'm listening carefully to the rivets, the space between them, the tone of them. Just in case I need someone to recreate the sound and figure out which bridge I've gone over. You can never be too careful. So I've just driven to 400 National Way in Simi Valley, and I'm standing outside the Playtronics headquarters, which at the moment is an Amazon delivery center. I almost didn't recognize it at first because they've done a lot of renovations to it. They've sort of facing the building, the middle has been changed, the left-hand side of the building is quite different. What gives it away, though, is the right-hand side. They've kind of left that the way it is. I'm pretty sure the windows are the same as they were back in 91 or whenever they shot these scenes. They've got the same pattern to them, the sort of three large panels broken up by a thin row
of rectangular panels, and they're all tinted the same way, the way they look in the film. And there's a column on the side of the building, which is the same shape. So this is definitely the spot. I got here at about midday, and a whole bunch of Amazon workers were filing out. So clearly a shift just ended. I'm obviously dressed as a gardener, trying to sneak my way in. I probably just could have brought a yellow high-vis jacket, and that would have done the trick, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of security around here, which is good. It means a lot of easy access. We don't have to crawl through the vents of the bathroom. I am tempted to go in and say, could I use your John? But I won't. I won't, because that would just be weird. I'm currently trying to work out where they film the over-the-shoulder shots, where they're planning the break-in and they're setting up the listening device and the bushes to hide themselves. There's really only one plausible candidate, but it's a fair way away. So I'm wondering if that was actually where they did it. There's really nowhere else it could have been. There are a couple of roads between here and there. It really is in the middle of nowhere. Like, I'm just looking around at the surrounds and it's just kind of green and yellow hills. So it is quite remote. I can see why they picked this place. It does feel like it's sort of been deliberately placed in the middle of nowhere. Very good location work. James Horner's score for Sneakers is one of the greatest soundtracks ever, I think. I think it's just beautiful. I've listened to it a million times. I know every beat of it. And I've started playing it as I've been driving through San Francisco. And I gotta say, it is a very different experience when you're actually here. It's pretty amazing. If you ever want a location to feel like a film, just travel through it and play the score. Just as an aside, I went to the symphony last night and discovered that I'd gotten here exactly one day too late to hear Branford Marsalis play. So that was frustrating, but that's okay. I reckon it's safe to say that San Francisco is one of the more romantic cities portrayed on film. There's something about the steep hills and the many bridges and the rolling fog that just gives it something that not a lot of other cities have. And I think that's part of the reason films like Vertigo are so evocative. There's a film that Guy Maddin made a couple of years ago called The Green Fog, which is basically a remake of Vertigo using clips from almost every film and television show shot in or set in San Francisco. It's very strange and very silly, but it also kind of shows that there is really something special about this place. And I've always wanted to visit because there is a real sort of urban romanticism about this city. Even when you're watching films like Zodiac, which are about serial killers, or, you know, something like Vertigo, which is really about obsession, there's still something quite, I guess, compelling about this place. And yet everything I hear about San Francisco tells me that it's incredibly dangerous. It's riddled with homelessness and crime, and the streets are filthy, and I just kept getting warned away from it. About 2 days before I got here, CNN aired an ad for a special called Whatever Happened to San Francisco, suggesting that the place is just unlivable now. It's complete opposite of the experience I've had here. The city is stunning. It's really taken my breath away, and it's one of the best cities I think I've seen. I'm really in love with the place. And in fact, the only place I was warned about more than San Francisco was Oakland, just over the bridge. It's said to be one of the more dangerous places. And yet...
Come on, don't break my shit. I'll break your goddamn neck. I will break your neck!
Make sure you get that on tape. Sure. Yeah, I was about to say the place is fine, but a guy just walked past screaming into his phone, I will break your neck, and then said as an aside to me, I make sure you got that on tape. So, yeah, it's a place of contrasts. So the reason I've come here is this is where the Sneakers headquarters are. I'm actually standing outside of them right now, outside the Fox Theatre. It is a theatre venue, and Future Islands and Ben Folds are coming up, apparently. The bottom level has a restaurant called The Den at the Fox. The top level, I just talked to a security guard, and the top level where the Sneakers were based, is now an art school, which feels appropriate.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
And now, Bay Area boy, Javier Panza, talking all things.
Well, it started because I grew up in Oakland, California, and I'd walk 3 blocks to the video rental store with my mom. And this VHS just looked awesome. You know, the design of it, the page. I don't think I recognize anyone on the box, but it must have been in our house at some point before. And so I would always rent it again and again. And it was one of those things where they say, you know, that River Phoenix is like a truant from the Oakland Unified School District. And that just like popped out to me. And that was like the trigger, like, oh, this is awesome. This is like theoretically like someone I could go to school with. And they're running around the Bay Area. And even as like a kid, I recognize enough places where, you know, the Sneakers headquarters is in the Fox Theater, which is like this historic old palace that now is like a revitalized place you can go see shows. And nowadays, the, like, you know, Oakland School of the Arts is in those upstairs offices where theoretically, like, the Sneakers office is. And that's where, like, you know, Zendaya, like, went to school there and stuff like that. So it really, like, popped out on that level. And so it just became a thing I'd love renting again and again. And it's the perfect kind of movie you see as a kid. And it's fun. The score is fun. It's like, you know, a gang, kind of like, you know, an Ocean's 11 type movie, probably what I was comparing it to at a young age, where you're like, oh yeah, they got this kind of guy and he does the phone stuff, and I got this kind of guy and he's into conspiracy things, and they got the kid and they got the cool guy who's like wearing a suit and he's a cop kind of, and then there's the crazy ex-hippie guy. And in the Bay Area growing up, these are all recognizable archetypes, like to one degree or another. Like, you know, my dad's a former hippie who went straight, and Robert Redford is basically just like the archetypal, like the boomer who is into all that stuff, maybe just to get girls. And now he's older and he's just trying to, like, you know, make a living. And the Dan Aykroyd guy, I like swear that dude, that kind of guy who just has all these theories about Managua and, you know, what's going on with cattle mutilations, that's a Berkeley Telegraph Avenue guy that growing up, there was a bookstore he used to go to, the 8th gravitational platform. It had no alphabetical author list. It was just books scattered around. You'd ask the guy, like, do you have this? And he'd squirrel away for 20 minutes, come back with the book. And that was Dan Aykroyd, it was that guy. And David Strathairn, you know, like the kind of like, my dad had a lot of friends who were like, you know, were in the kind of like the disabled rights community. And they were just like hardcore, like, I can live alone and independently. And that reminded me of them. And just all of these like characters just like spoke to me. And then of course, the bridge scenario of, you know, can you remember which bridge you were on?
What does it sound like?
Yeah, I mean, if you grew up in the Bay Area, you're on bridges all the time, going to San Francisco, different places. So that just immediately jumped out at me. And it wasn't until later on, like, you know, high school, college, I'd see it again and again. And then I was like, wow, they really, like, every kind of beat of the movie is built around some Bay Area institution. When he says, like, I'm going to go to UC and check out this guy's lecture, they're going to Berkeley to go see what this, you know, guy's talking about. The Coolidge Institute seems like kind of like something at Stanford. Like, I think they have like a Hoover Institute or something like that. And that felt really real. And then the whole idea of like, oh, this is like, you know, Silicon Valley right before the dot-com boom. And there's a toy company and all this other stuff. That felt like, as I got older, I was like, oh, I like recognize this as like, this is all, they're just crisscrossing the Bay Area doing all these things. And even like the idea that Mary McDowell is like, you know, kind of a fancier lady in the city, has a cool apartment that they have to crash into. And when he gets dumped on her doorstep later on, like that all felt like, oh, wow, they, whoever wrote this was really like, felt like they were connected to the Bay Area and thought about not just how to use a location, but how do all like the places, institutions fit into this. So I just always loved it for that reason. And then, you know, probably in the last 10 to 15 years, WikiLeaks happens, the 2016 election happens,
yes.
And this whole idea that like information is warfare and that it's at the center of everything and it's not about bullets anymore. You just like revisit this movie you think is like this fun heist thing. And then they're like, oh my God, they were predicting the future here a little bit. Like, it's just one of those things where like every layer of it, it's way more complex and like interesting. And has a different twist than like you kind of remember. And then you find all these other weirdos online who are like, oh, this is the best movie ever. And you're like, really? Oh, okay. I got to go back and check this out again. And so there's just always something there for you to like kind of discover or vibe with.
It's so cool to hear you talk about like the, even the topography of San Francisco, the correlations between the different libraries, because when you read about, you know, Phil Arden Robinson and his co-collaborators on this, who co-wrote Sneakers with him, the 10 years that they were writing this book, writing this screenplay as Lawrence Lasker and Walter F. Pass were his key collaborators, they talked about going to libraries, like probably the UC Berkeley Library, potentially, walking into the Berkeley Library and like going to a new field like technology, cryptography, whatever, and just starting to read, do their thing, like start figuring it out. And their personalities and their life in the Bay Area like continued to kind of bleed into it. So it's so interesting because you're like, the philosophy of the main character feels like that Bay Area guy, that hippie who turns straight. And all of these guys were that guy, like, except that, you know, they were a little bit younger than Robert Redford at the time that they were writing it. But it kind of feels like it's so cool that you're talking about even just as much detail as the topography of the town is so essential to the characters. Because yeah, it feels like, you know, the difference between a San Francisco movie and a Bay Area movie is vast sometimes, because like the San Francisco movie is just like, is the landmarks and the hills and going up and down and certain parks and streets and etc. But Bay Area is like got more personality. It's like where people actually live. And I say that about Sydney a lot. I'm like, yeah, like there's Sydney, the Opera House, the Harbour Bridge, the Bondi Beach. And then there's Sydney where people live. And
yeah,
they're not the same thing.
No. Well, what's interesting you say that, because this last watch, I was looking at the scene where they're looking at Stephen Tobolowsky's address, and he lives in Palo Alto, which, you know, now is like, you know, super, super very expensive place to live. And even then would have been. But it is sort of like a boring suburban kind of town. And that would be where like a Tobolowsky type lives. And what I really love about the movie is, you're right, so many San Francisco movies are like, it's the location, it's probably a movie about cops, there's like some sick car chases, but they don't really venture too far out of SF. An exception, of course, Basic Instinct is another great one where they hop around the bay in that one in a way I like. But the thing that's great about this one is when they do the bridge, when they're recreating like, oh, let's go find the cocktail party. They like follow the geography where they take the bridge where it would go to like Fremont. And that's where there's a lot of tech campuses. And like, you know, that's where like Tesla started out, and where you can like, you know, from there you're in San Jose and you can go, that is where that would be. And the other thing that I love about it is that the actual like Playtronics headquarters, they filmed somewhere in Santa Clarita in a suburb of LA. And it's, very strange because in Terminator 2, the Cyberdyne headquarters was filmed in Fremont in a location that's basically where Playtronics would be in that universe. But they filmed that up there, but in T2, that would have been somewhere in SoCal. So it's kind of this weird, I just always think of those two like locations as being like married together because they're kind of flip.
Yeah, and they're so close to each other too, right? It's like it is 92 and Terminator's 91. So it's like big movie, big scale, big action sequence, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So what else? So apart from it being a Bay Area movie that you've revisited so many times and you found all these ways into it, what are the things that are still hanging around for you? And what are the lingering, I guess, things that you continue to be interested in? I think we touched a little bit on it about like its prescience. It's kind of like weird foreboding predictions of what life would be, but what else is still hanging around for you?
This last rewatch, it really struck me how it's one of the few movies that melds several different genres into one coherently, where you kind of don't notice that it's flipping from the fun heist part of a movie like The Hot Rock or Ocean's 11. And then you get a little bit of this conspiracy stuff, especially with Redford's casting, where you're thinking about, you know, 3 Days of the Condor and you're thinking about all the president's men. But then, like, it's just like this very, very kind of fast paced action movie at other times. And then it gets quiet and has this drama about these two guys' friendship that's like strained and like, you know, gets settled decades later. And it really like kind of goes between all of those things. But then peppered in are these awesome, like almost David Mamet, like kind of constructions of like con games where it's like, you know, River Phoenix is trying to like get this guy freaked out about the Drano so Redford can sneak in. And it's just like all these little genre things pop up and they're all coherent. They're all make sense together. And they're just extremely fun. And of course, the score is so like propulsive and weird. Like it really like touches. I just rewatched Tenet in IMAX and was thinking about how like that movie is really tied together by that score, like never lets up. It's going, going, going. And this one is sort of similar where it's just like, it's kind of doing different things, but it's kind of tying you together. And it's just so nuts that it's James Horner. Cause I sometimes think of him as kind of like Hans Zimmer, like where it's like, this guy does a lot. And sometimes he repeats himself, often maybe he repeats himself, but every now and again, he'll do one where it's like, this is some fresh stuff I like and throwing out at you and check this out. And it's like, unlike anything else.
Yeah. Horner's a really fascinating choice sometimes. Cause another movie, which I completely adore from around this time period is The Pelican Brief. And I feel like that's him doing his sneakers score like Hans Zimmer would. Like it's so bombastic and it feels so over the top. And you're like, the delicate touch, deft, you know, really tender way that the sneakers score kind of caresses the whole movie and does beautiful and unexpected things and keeps it twisty and does all that beautiful harmony or that a great score can do. Sometimes in the Pelican Brief, it feels like he's going, bah, 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 smashing your face in. And you're like, dude, chill. You know, watch all the President's Men. David Shire is where we need you to be right now. We need, you know, James Horner. You know, we need you to just bring it back at a level. But he did such a great job. And Phil Adam Robinson says that, you know, they tempt the movie with a lot of contemporary things like from Philip Glass and took James Horner and said, we've sort of tempted the movie with this feeling. We want you to see if you can capture this feeling for us. And he went away and they were so pleased with what he came up with.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. That's a cool decision by him to kind of move him in that direction. And I mean, the other thing that I just love is Sidney Poitier is so funny in this.
Yeah.
I feel like you're kind of, I mean, now that I'm older and I'm like, wait, this guy's won like best actor. And he's like, this is kind of a strange role for him to be in. Like you'd think like he would be the Robert Redford type or something. I don't know, but he's clearly having so much fun. I mean, the bit where they're looking at the couple or Donald Logan, the woman, and they're starting to have sex and Redford's looking at it. And then Sidney Poitier just the lightest whisper. Let me see. It's totally cracked. It just killed me.
And they push poor Carl away. They push poor Carl away from the lens and like, come on, calm down, Carl. Come on, don't be get serious. And then he's
grow up. Yeah.
Grow up. Let me Nice.
He has so many comedy chops. I mean, when they're telling Redford that he's got to be the one to go real slow, and Sidney Poitier just slaps him on the shoulder and says, "You get all the fun stuff," and walks away.
The delivery, that's a line delivery I've never forgotten in my life, where he goes, "You get all fun stuff." And he just says it with that Sidney charm that you can't, it's just like impossible to reach for any actor. And he's just like, "You get all fun stuff." It's just the best.
Well, and even the whole bit at the end where they kind of tease throughout, why did you have to leave the CIA? And at the very end, when the guy says the racist slur, and he just goes, "Did I ever tell you why I had to leave? My temper." And you can sort of imagine this whole like, oh, this guy was like probably really good at his job, had to deal with some racist shit, and was just like, "I'm fucking out of here, guys." And it's just like, it's like such a good actor. You kind of like build this thing of like, oh, okay, this does make sense why you're here with all these like goofballs.
Yeah, but that's, I think they're all having, I think that that's the secret, right? It's like, you can be with the most talented people, but sometimes the most talented aren't the most fun. You know? Like,
yeah, no, I think of my friends. They're clearly always having a bit.
Yeah, I think of my friends or favorite people I've ever worked with in my life on different projects and stuff, and man, we're having fun. And we've got lots of capacity to be silly. And so I feel like these guys just have to, you know, it's part of their relationship. That's why they're so infectious. That's why I think someone like you and people like me and all the other people that love sneakers do this. We love hanging out with this crew. They're just so like infectious. They're so fun and silly, and they're also really good, but they just have that perfect chemistry with each other. Like in Australia, we say take the piss. They take the piss out of each other constantly, but they love each other and they're really good.
Yeah. And well, it is all about fun, and it is such a weird thing looking back on it. The whole bit where they're celebrating the big score and they all go and talk about, you know, what they're going to spend with their money. That's so fun. But then they keep on having fun, and it's like, we're literally going to go play a board game now, and the two of us can go screw around over here. And it kind of takes its time to just let you hang out in their cool space and see how they dance. And like, you do just want to hang out in the sneakers headquarters and just goof around with these guys. And they're like funky outfits. I think like Carl's wearing scrubs at one point. And just like, it's like a very weird kind of like goofy collection of characters. The other thing that I never noticed until this rewatching it a couple of days ago was when Ben Kingsley gives his like intense speech over the intercom to the whole building. All the camera angles that they choose during that all kind of look like actual, like where a security camera would be. And they're kind of going through the whole building and kind of doing this like scanny thing. And I never noticed that. I have no like real take about it. I just thought it was cool. And just like this movie looks like incredible. It really is such a great throwback to back when it was like, you know, they're gonna light movies. Like, I mean, when he gets thrown out of the car on top of the hill in San Francisco, there's like a plane flying by and like Alcatraz is back there and it's just like perfectly like backlit and he turns into the city. It's just like, this was so, like the even kind of your, you know, not terribly serious action movies or thriller, I don't know what you would call this exactly, they look like phenomenal. Well, it's also just so funny how even at his like lowest point, he just looks so fantastic. He's got a trench coat on, and
he can't look bad.
The whole movie, he's living just like the absolute boomer dream of like, I got jeans, I got a cool sports coat, I got these kind of funky loafers on, and like his glasses. He just looks so like the epitome of a dude of that generation, of any generation. He just looks so good. On a fashion note, the other key thing about this movie being a Bay Area classic is that Aykroyd rocks the backwards A's cap. Mm-hmm. He rocks a Niners hat that River Phoenix duplicates. And very early in the movie, when he's severing the master alarm bridge clip, whatever, he's got a hard hat with a San Jose Sharks sticker on it. So they're like really covering like almost every base. I mean, the Raiders were not in the Bay Area at that point, so I think they have every major team represented in the movie. And just like, you know, I mean, the thing I want to know is when they were making this movie, I mean, how much of this was inspired by like them living in the Bay Area? Like this is like, there's so many great uses of people, places, things that like these guys must have been hanging out in Berkeley in like the 60s or later on or something. I mean, the Silicon Valley stuff, like this is a very Bay Area movie. It's not by accident.
That concludes episode 7, the second last episode of our Too Many Minutes series. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Huge thank you to Lee Zachariah for not only being a necessary nudge to make this series happen, but also for his like unbelievable on the ground reporting. I hope you really enjoyed the sense of what it's to be in the locations. And a special thank you to journalist and Bay Area native Javier Panza to talk to us about like just how ingrained the place of San Francisco and the Bay Area is in sneakers and why that is part of its enduring charm. The final episode of our Too Many Minutes series, episode 8, is coming in a couple of days. Wrapping up the series before we get to our new series, Roam In. Hope you've enjoyed it. I've been your host, Blake Howard. If you enjoy our series, please go to patreon.com/oneheatminute. You can support the show with a very modest donation. If you want to see what other shows we've got going on, go to oneheatminute.com. We have our entire Michael Mann deep dives, including One Heat Minute, Miami Nice, and Min Hunter. We have all of our other fantastic shows, Increment Vice, Josie and the Podcats, you name it. They're all there. Go check them out. If you want to contact us, mail@oneheatminute.com. or One Blake Minute on the socials for myself and OHM Pods on the socials as well. We'll catch you on another episode very, very soon.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone. Which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.